Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The new theatrical touring production of Blue Man Group is at Columbus's Palace Theater through February 12th. It's just one stop on its first theatrical production to tour North America. And that's The Sizzler from the Blue Man Group. The show features brand new content as well as a new physical layout, including a design centering around an LED curtain big enough to fill, I guess, what you'd think of as the vertical and horizontal opening of the stage, and a high-resolution screen as well. It's all very smashing, but it wouldn't amount to a hill of digitized beans without the stars. The ultimate foils, the Blue Men of the Blue Man Group. Joining us today are three stars of the touring production in Columbus right now. Kalen Almandinger.
That's right.
He has performed with Blue Man Group all over the world after studying acting at Chicago College of Performing Arts, where he worked with Looking Glass, About Face, and Chicago Shakespeare Theater Companies. Welcome to the show, Kalen.
Thanks for having me.
And Kirk Massey, he's been with Blue Man Group since 2005 and has performed in New York, Boston, Orlando, and all over the world as part of Blue Man Group's How to Be a Megastar World Tour. It was in Columbus a few years ago. Welcome back, Kirk.
Thank you very much.
And also Brian Taverner, who is a Blue Man in Boston, where he also runs an independent record label, Carrot Policeman Records, and plays in the band The And Company. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
There is a website, theandcompany.com. Have to mention that. So The Sizzler from the Blue Man Group, is that with the show now or is that?
It is, yeah.
Because I have to tell you, I saw it last night and it's just such a collage of experience that I really couldn't identify when I listened to this morning.
Right, yeah. It's Kalen? A little overwhelming sometimes. And that piece we play during the finale, which is kind of the epitome of that. There are all of these elements that come together, and it's a little almost overwhelming. There's so much that's happening at once, and it kind of turns into this crazy dance party, and everyone gets out of their seats and jumps around, as you know.
As I said, I still have my glob of confetti from last night. So how do you get to be a Blue Man?
Well, Kirk? We most of us have an acting background and a music background. I mean, that's sort of what we're looking for in the casting process. But we all pretty much, just like any show, we auditioned for the show at some point. Me in particular, I went to an open call in Chicago where anybody can come, but we have some certain like requirements, more or less. Like, we try to hire guys between 5'10 and 6'1", athletically built to that. And then from there, it's strong actors, strong musicians. And the audition is sort of like a workshop. Like, you'll do a little bit of drumming, you'll do some acting exercises, usually with another Blue Man that happens to be there. And if all goes well, you'll get invited back, usually to the next day of the callback. And then ultimately culminates in New York for the final callback, where you learn like a little section of the show, and then you perform that for directors and other people with the company. And if that works, then you get hired into training, and you train for like 4 weeks, and then you do the show.
It's such an interesting process. You have to eventually, coming from a background that isn't quite studied in either theater or music, I kind of had to eventually just accept the fact that if I was going to be a Blue Man, they know the show, they wrote the show, they know if I am a Blue Man. So I then can just let that go and do what needs to be done to learn the show and have a good time, have an experience. I mean, that's what the show is, and it is an experience anyway. And to get the job, I kind of had to drop the I've got to prove something to someone aspect and just kind of be myself and hope that that would fit the character.
Well, be yourself, and yet it's such a seemingly anonymous role.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big part of it. You know, it's Blue Man Group. It's very much about the three of us acting in concert, you know, to achieve a shared goal. And so that's kind of what we're trying to mine out of those auditions, the ability to work with people and to take direction and just play well in an ensemble, you know, to listen and react and that sort of thing. And we're certainly not looking for a Blue Man at that stage. We're looking for the potential,
The chemistry.
Absolutely, very much so. Yeah.
And sort of like, what is it about, as much as everything like Kalen was saying about working well within the ensemble, but also, what is something that's like particular to your personality, or something that's just a part of you that works with the character, and it's like a side of the character that maybe they haven't seen or something like that. It just kind of comes out because, like, once you, like, you learn the rules of the character and what the Blue Man is and break down like, the three individual Blue Men, then it's a little bit of also what is it about you? What's the Blue Man sort of inside of you personally that'll come out into it? And that's always an interesting thing to watch in the casting process is when somebody has that side to them that is very Blue Man, but it's also very unique to them, and then how that fits into the group aspect as well.
My guests are the stars of the new touring production of the Blue Man Group, Kirk Massey, Kaylin Allmendinger. Am I pronouncing that right?
It is, yeah. Allmendinger.
Allmendinger, okay.
Yeah.
And Brian Taverner. All three, if you have a question or comment, if you saw the show last night, it opened last night at the Palace Theater. It's playing there through the 12th. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Tell us what you thought. Maybe you've seen a Blue Man Group show before, and you want to talk about that as well. These guys have been around, so they could probably chat you up on just about any aspect of it. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Post your question or comment there. We take that. And you can tweet me at Ann Fisher WOSU. We are a multi-purpose communicator here today. So why you talk about the Blue Man in you. That's an intriguing idea. What when you think about the Blue Man in you, what are you thinking about, Brian?
Well, there's a number of things. Kind of the child. It's a really a connection to being a kid again. I was actually just talking earlier with Rolanda, our press person that's with us, about the Fountain of Youth. I feel like Blue Man for me has kind of felt like a little bit of a Fountain of Youth, like holding on to something that maybe was lost along the way or forgotten about going through the rigmarole, I would say, of college, of even high school. And each step of the way is kind of maybe you're fulfilling a requirement and rather than following something that was inside of you. And so this Blue Man job has kind of gotten the connection back, the following, I guess, follow your bliss, the message of the show, but following something that's there that you kind of lose through society and social evolution of your own life. But yeah, I just think of the connection with the kid in me, and that's kind of what the character is the innocent, ever-searching, ever-probing character that kind of no one ever told the character how to do something or what to do about something. So really it's kind of that exploration that can be found outside of the show as well. It's really interesting what the show does for me personally, you know, in life now. I kind of act differently, feel differently, walking down the street in, of these all these cities we visit. And a little bit more youthful, a little bit more energetic.
By the way, they're not exactly, you know, ancient history sitting here, but it's all relative, right?
Right. Well, I mean, it's really cool, like what Brian was saying, like, and just that concept of sort of like the Blue Man sort of inside of us. And like the Blue Man in a way is sort of like what we would all be if we didn't grow up in a world with like any sort of judgment or like social mass. Like as we get older, like it was funny, I had an acting teacher tell me one time, like he's like, when you were a cowboy as a little kid and you ran outside and you were 3 years old and you're a cowboy, you were the best cowboy in the world. You didn't come inside from playtime. You're like, I just wasn't very believable today as a cowboy. I just really didn't pull off. And that's sort of just like judgment free, just sort of like void of any sort of fear of that sort of thing is sort of like a place that the Blue Man lives in. Like he doesn't have the fear of I'm going to do this wrong or I don't know how to do this type of thing. And that's something that one of our founders, Chris Wink, a lot of times will give lectures to like different business groups and things like that. It has a lot to do with a lot of things. Sometimes it's just the business model Blue Man, but like even the company, we try to work in that type of way. It's like an outside the box, judgment free sort of zone, like an innocent zone and like so much come out of that, so much collaborative work and just creativity and just things like when you're not afraid of your idea being shot down or being judged by if you do this wrong or something like that, that's when you get sort of outside the box and you just come up with crazy creative things that you never would have.
You know, even though you all look in a way exactly alike on stage, because most people haven't seen you in person, so they have no reference point, all blue, and yet these personalities come out.
Right, yeah. Well, and the, of course, the makeup has a lot to do with that. It sort of erases a lot of...
Exactly. So you can't draw from what someone's wearing.
Right.
Like, you can't make judgments about what kind of belt they're wearing or how they have their hair. You have to go by some sort of essence.
And, exactly. And then it also comes down to the circumstances, the given circumstances of, you know, moment to moment within the show. And then it's all about, I guess, status comes into play. And as far as setting up the moments for a punchline, for example, or any kind of payoff in the show, it's all nothing is given in a way, because it is that sort of blank canvas. And so we, each thing is approached with fresh eyes, and then, you know, you quickly build up some expectations and then destroy them and get a big laugh or you know, let the air out of the bag, so to speak.
When you auditioned Kirk for the role, was this something you really wanted, or were you just out auditioning in a phase of your career where you're looking for a job? Did you know you really wanted to be a Blue Man?
Blue Man specifically, actually, when I auditioned, I wasn't 100% sure what it was. Like, I always knew from young age I wanted to be involved in arts in some way, right, whether it was going to be acting or music or whatever it was. That's always been my passion since a kid. And somebody along the way, like in college, was like, hey, they knew I was a drummer, they knew I was an actor. Like, have you heard of this thing called Blue Man Group? I think you would be great for it. And at the time, I had no idea what it was. I think the only thing I knew was like the old Intel commercials that we did a while back. I was like, the three guys who do commercials. I was like, well, I'm not sure how I fit into this. And I just quickly watched, I think, something online and was like, that looks interesting. And I went the first day of the auditions that I went to, I just knew, hey, this is theater and this is music, something I want to be involved in. And then as I was going through the audition process, I actually finally saw the show and just was blown away. From the time I saw the show, I was like, okay, this is what I was made to do at this point in my life. I was like, this, I have to be a part of this. And somehow, like, I was to the point that even if I didn't get cast as the role, I was like, I'm moving to a city where the show is. I'm going to work on the crew. I was like, I want to be a part of this environment in any way I can. And I mean, fortunately, things worked out and I ended up actually landing the role. But once I saw it, I was like, yes, this is what I'm made for at this point in time.
Brian, was it something you knew you wanted before you auditioned for it? Because I would imagine the audition process would kind of suck you in, just the process itself.
It was pretty similar to what Kirk mentioned. I mean, I had actually put together a package of audition material for Cirque du Soleil for some music role as a musician. I was kind of more in that side of things. I had not done a couple plays in a couple years, and I had kind of phased into playing with a band on tour that we put together in the East Coast. And I had seen the show come through on Megastar in Raleigh, North Carolina, where I was living at the time, and really was blown away by the I guess you say collage. You used the word collage earlier. And the character just being so mysterious but playful, and it just fit where I was at the time in life. And I felt like, okay, maybe I'll send this stuff in to Blue Man. It was really from that point on, as I said, kind of I tried to put it on Blue Man's side, like give the ball to Blue Man and say, hey, you guys know what you're doing. If I fit, thank you. If not, this is a ride for me, and I'm going to ride it as long as I can, you know, as far as I can. And luckily, again, you know, everything fell into place, and I rode it all the way into the role, and I'm still on the ride. It kind of never stopped. So yeah, I guess not really. There wasn't a means to an end. It was just kind of fun.
Gosh, we have to take a break. My guests are Brian Tavner, Kaylin Almendinger, Kirk Massey. They're all Blue Men with the Blue Man Group. If you have a question or comment for them, and you might, because they don't say anything when they're performing, so this is your chance. Maybe that's why everyone's listening so closely. They're intrigued that the Blue Men have a voice, and they certainly do. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Give us a call. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Be sure to join All Sides with Ann Fisher for a special live broadcast on location at WOSU at Cosi. Be a part of the studio audience next Tuesday, February 14th, from 10 until noon. In the first hour, we'll discuss current challenges facing Columbus's historic urban neighborhood, Franklinton. And then in the second hour, we will celebrate Columbus's bicentennial with Mayor Michael Coleman and a panel. Join All Sides at WOSU at Cosi. Be a part of the audience Tuesday, February 14th, from 10 until noon.
Support for 89.7 comes from COSI, presenting Race, Are We So Different? This exhibit looks at the science and history of race in America with photography, artifacts, and hands-on activities. It's an exhibit for the whole family. More information at COSI.org.
30 degrees in downtown Columbus, some snow expected today, less than an inch of accumulation, a high of 35. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 21. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
That's more music from the Blue Man Group. Joining us today, three of the Blue Men in the production right now at the Palace. It is Columbus. They're at the Columbus Palace Theater through February 12th. It's one stop on its first theatrical production to tour North America. We're going to talk about what makes it a theatrical versus whatever kind of production they do. So if you have a question or comment for my guests, Brian Tavener, Kaylin Almendinger, Kirk Massey, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We do have an email from Tom. He writes, what makes a blue man blue? Of course, we were talking, you know, sort of in the esoteric sense before, and now we're talking about physically. He's saying a mask, paint. If paint, what kind? Kaylin?
Well, it's a little of both. We have a latex, or I guess a vinyl. I don't think it's latex, a vinyl bald cap that we glue onto our face so it covers up, it goes around our hairline, so it covers up our hair and our ears, and then we trim it and re-glue the edges so that it looks seamless, and then we just slop on a bunch of blue grease paint over.
How do you keep it from rubbing off? I notice sometimes during the show you actually wipe it off and put it on someone's cheek or whatever.
Yeah.
But it looks very fluid.
Yeah. There's some I actually just heard, we loaded into the Palace yesterday, and I had heard one of the house staff members right before the show saying, oh, I've seen this show, don't get near him, you're going to get it all over you. And I was like, no, that's not the case. I mean, it definitely is able to come off. It's just something that we, I think, with years of practice, kind of get used to not getting as dirty as we could get.
Not touching your face as much.
Right. You can tell there's always a funny joke. You can always tell the new guys from the old guys because their costume is just completely messy at the end of the show, and the older guys are kind of pristine by the end.
Yeah. Well, how do you keep the paint from getting, when you're playing the drums and that sort of thing, how do you do that?
Well, the paint is just on our heads, and so we wear blue gloves.
But I mean, I'm talking about the paint from the, oh, you're talking about pristine, meaning your costume paint is not getting on the clothes.
Right, like the face, blue grease paint itself.
Well, yeah. The other paint we use in the show is the paint that we pour on the drums and play them and something like that. It's a much lighter paint, and so when it does get on the costume or on our heads, it kind of just soaks in. It doesn't really, like, it's a black costume, so the color just kind of soaks in. You don't really see bright colors in the costume anymore, and the paint's a much lighter paint than the thick grease paint that we put on our heads, and so it just kind of soaks into the paint on our heads as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the idea of the theatrical production and what that means. This is all new now. Before, when the Megastar tour was at the arenas and it was huge, this is different. What makes it different, Kirk?
Well, actually, the Megastar tour, the sort of like a rock concert tour, was almost like a sequel kind of to the theatrical production. Like, it was almost already an understanding of the character, and they're like, well, now let's hit the character and drop it into this rock concert environment and you see what he does, how he explores this space and explores this cultural icon that is a rock concert. Whereas the theatrical show, one, it's more of a complete introduction to the character. If you've never seen the show before and don't know anything about it, you get a more understanding. You get to watch the process and go on the same journey with the Blue Man as he's discovering things. But it's much more about that. It's much more about the Blue Man in this world on this particular night with this specific individual audience, and how can the three Blue Men connect to this audience and connect to basically this environment that we're in for the night, sort of a thing. And he's constantly exploring and trying to figure out, well, they seem to talk. I don't have vocal cords for whatever reason, so I'm going to try drumming. Does that work? I'm going to try pouring paint on the drum to make, or do you understand this? Are we agreeing on this? And just going through the show in that way and exploring basically the space that way.
Did you want to say something, Kiel?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that also in this more theatrical version, it sort of allows for more intimate moments as well. Mm-hmm. The rock concert was a huge production. We played mostly in arenas or outdoor sheds and that sort of venue. And so this one has a little bit more, it sort of runs the gamut a little bit more. It still has all of that huge flash and technological mayhem. But there are also simple, quiet, focused moments as well, which is a lot of fun to kind of...
I'm enjoying it. I'm actually one of the newer guys on this particular tour, but I'm enjoying the idea of having performed the theatrical show in an intimate space in Boston. We performed at the Charles Playhouse in Boston for about 520 people.
Very small audience.
Sold out, right. Yeah. And it's interesting to take that pretty much similar show that's happening there now. Now that these domestic shows have this show that we're performing on this tour, it's interesting to take that into this arena and this space, because you can make an audience of 2,000 people feel the exact same. You can make it feel like it's 200 people, and it's amazing the connection that can happen with that many people in a bigger space, but it's kind of a similar result.
Gabe in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gabe.
Hi, it's kind of amazing. I was just thinking about the same thing. My wife and I saw the Blue Man Group in Chicago, you know, and it was a really intimate, I guess, setting with a lot of audience participation. And I saw them also in Cleveland on the Megastar. And we're going tonight. We've been so excited about going that we're taking our two young daughters with us as well, because they've heard all about it. So I was just curious as how intimate was it going to be tonight versus the Megastar and the other production that I saw before the Megastar in Chicago. But we've really enjoyed both shows.
Great. Thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing you tonight. It's sort of in between. It's a little bit closer to, it kind of has the same bone structure as the Chicago show, although there is a lot of new material written specifically for this touring production. So it does expand a little bit and get a little bit more, there's more, a little more spectacle. But we still invite people up on stage with us, and we have a meal with a woman that we invite up on stage, and you might remember that from Chicago as well. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. It's got a little bit of everything.
Great. Well, we're really excited to see it tonight. So
all right.
Thank you for taking our call.
Come say hi afterwards.
Thanks, Gabe.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. My guest, the Blue Man, will be here for another 10 minutes or so. So don't wait till the last minute. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was wondering, how structured is the script? How much of it, how much do they write out every, how much do they write out? I guess it's just the simple question.
We've got a similar, well, pretty much the same order of pieces each show, each night. This is a very common thing I like to think about, because a lot of people say, how do you do the same show every night? How do you perform the same show? And I just don't feel that way based on it's every night is different based on the audience and the different vibe that you're presented with in the space. From the very opening of the show, you can tell that it's a different night. And we know that we're about to do the same order of pieces. The other thing is the combination of guys on stage kind of and what positions they play will change everything as well. So it's actually kind of more of a challenge and more fun to think about and rewarding to think about what could happen even with that same order of pieces. I mean, if it were a different order, a different set list like a band, I don't even know if that would be as challenging. And the challenge is to find the newness of the same order of pieces between the three of us.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's interesting is the show is definitely written. Like, we have writers of the show, but there's no, like, actual tangible script. Like, if you were doing Phantom of the Opera, you get your script that's completely scored out word by word what you're doing every night. We get more like a vague verbal outline that's been passed down to us of the individual pieces in the show. And then it's basically we get the kind of freedom to make those pieces then come alive every night. And actually we're challenged in a lot of ways, make it new, make something interesting, or do the exact same thing, but make it different type of a thing. And it's, yeah, we have like a more like a set list than we do an actual like script that we're going by.
Yeah, and it's really based on, like you said, the audience and what they bring to it, because the character is actively searching for that response. You know, there's no fourth wall, and I think that's also what makes it kind of intriguing as an audience member, because you really can feel that you're in the same space and that this being up on stage is looking directly at you and responding to to your responses. And so that really, you know, steers the feel of it from night to night.
You talked about, putting it in quotation marks, dinner with one of the audience members. And I caught up with her last night after the show, and I asked her what she would ask you if she could, because, of course, she can't talk to you during the show. And she said she wanted to know what that stuff was coming out of the breastplate that you put on her before. And you don't have to necessarily tell us, because I don't want to give it away, but I told her I would ask you anyway.
It's her life spirit, physicalized.
That's right. A little bit of her soul.
She doesn't even know.
How do you pick the people out? It is random, right?
Yeah. Everyone that we interact with is, you know, a paying customer who comes to see the show that night. And we just really try to find somebody who looks like they're having a good time and who would have an even better time maybe getting a little bit more involved. You know, we certainly don't force anybody. We go out and we just kind of look for somebody who's maybe a little shy but still very into it and excited.
Yeah, we look for somebody that's going to have like a really real reaction with us. Like, we don't want to pull somebody that's all of a sudden going to turn into an actor when they get up there and have their 15 minutes of fame. Like, we want somebody that it's going to be on the same level. We are have a very real connection and real experience with us up there and hopefully going to, I mean, be a good sport. We definitely want somebody that, like Caitlin said, is having a good time and will hopefully play around and take the sort of suggestions we're making up there, but experiencing it just completely real and completely with us the whole time.
Again, that choice is based on the audience, based on the evening. The woman we bring up is, and also the man earlier on, or I'm sorry, later on in the show, is they are ambassadors of that audience. So when you're picking a member to bring up, it's you have to take in where the show has been already that evening in the first, I guess, 30 minutes or so that we've done the show. Where is the show at, and who is going to represent this audience as a whole, and will they take something back to them after the scene is over? And all that comes into play. It's really great because everyone is actively thinking about who will be the best in that moment. It's a really great moment.
How do you communicate with each other who you're going to pick, or does one of you just take the initiative and grab the hand kind of a moment?
The one that sits next to her ultimately has like the final say in the thing, but it's basically the same way we communicate on stage. Like,
okay, sits next to her at the table during the meal.
Because he's going to be the one next to her, he kind of gets the last say in the matter, but it's the same way that like we communicate through the whole show. Like, we just have a way of being able to communicate with our eyes to each other and kind of know what each other's thinking. Like, it's really cool. Like, the show, like, you can get on stage with somebody, another blue man, maybe from a different production that you've never met up until 30 minutes before you're about to go on stage with them, and be able to have that same type of communication. It's just sort of something that we've all been trained to do, or all just have that like storytelling ability to do. And we just can kind of look at each other. And it's sort of like when you're with your best friend and you're at lunch and something happens at the table, you're at a table next to you, and you just look at each other and you know what each other's thinking. It's the same sort of thing.
Love those looks. Love those moments. Artie, Isaac, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So I teach creativity at Ohio State University in the business school, the Fisher School of Business, and there is a wonderful case written by Harvard on the Blue Man Group, and we use that in our class. It from a business school perspective, watching the the origin of the I'll call it a business, but the art, and the consistency with which the Blue Man ethic is described, and the strange abilities and realizations of the original founders, is the stuff of business school study because of the success of this this enterprise.
It's a really that's an amazing thing to bring up. I'm actually glad that's an example. There's definitely business. I love how you said, I'll call it a business, but it's an art. But, you know, it's both. You have to, at some point, if something is going to get large, it needs to take on a business side, you know, and any artist will tell you that eventually, unless they're just going to be keeping it as a hobby and not taking it to the next level, that it's got, you've got to get some infrastructure in there and really know what you're doing. And there's some interesting trees that we are presented with that it all starts at the character. Everyone that works for this business knows who the Blue Man is. They know what the character is about. They believe in the character, and it starts there, and it kind of sprouts from there, and there's all these trees and ways to take it, and you have to have that through line. You have to have the connection to your art to form your business, but it's very important to maintain a professional structured atmosphere. But I don't know, somehow this company's done it and stayed completely artful on all ends. If you see the offices, you'll know what I mean.
It provides a great example to young students who are worried about this economy, and they think that their ideas are crazy, and their ideas aren't crazy. Their ideas are nutritious and reasonable. So they read the Blue Man Group case, and they realize, oh, this is what crazy looks like.
Yeah,
and
it's all good.
Yeah, what crazy looks like when it works. And why does it work? It works because of a certain entrepreneurial stubbornness and sense of mission and purpose and willingness to amplify the absurdity of the individual, the endearing absurdity of an individual. So I thank you for what you're doing, because you bring this case to life, and my students get to come down and see exactly what it looks like.
Well, thanks for being the teacher.
You're
Thanks,
welcome.
Artie. Thanks for
Bye.
Calling. Take care. We are almost out of time. Audience participation is key to the experience. It changes it up for you. I think it's interesting how you talk about the people that you bring out of the audience as ambassadors of the audience and representative of it. I thought that they both were great last night. It was a lot of fun. She was particularly, I don't know. I just loved how she just, I would have had, now you luckily didn't pick someone like me, I would have wanted to say, well, I couldn't have helped talking, because of course that's what I do too much of, but but I was wondering how you found the Columbus audience. Do you find, given the importance of the audience, and I know audience energy affects any live performer, mm-hmm. but how about the Columbus audience? What did you think of it on opening night versus, you know, thumbs up?
Two thumbs up.
Two Absolutely. Thumbs up, really. Yeah,
they were great. I mean, and it's interesting, because this is It's funny, it's a very small like backstage area, but the actual like house is pretty
it's a beautiful
big. Yeah, it's yeah. beautiful, and it's just really it's kind of a sea. It kind of keeps going and going, but it's still they very much felt like, even like the back row, the balcony felt very much into the show last night, like we were having that intimate connection even far back, which in bigger houses, sometimes that's hard
to achieve. I really wanted to get those balls up to them. Yeah. I felt badly. Yeah. Just can't get those.
We're trying. Yeah. We're trying.
Sometimes it goes on. I've watched a show from the balcony before, and you know, everyone is waiting, of course, when that moment happens for the ball to come up to them. And sometimes it will, and sometimes it'll be a fleeting, brief moment. And there's always this big, excited like inhale, and then as soon as it leaves, you just hear the whole audience go, oh,
because everybody wants them to yeah. have as much fun.
Unfortunately, for some reason, the instinct of like the front row of the balcony wants to get up there is to just hit it right back down yeah. and go behind them, no, backwards. Right.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate all
thank
your time
you,
and energy. Kaylin Almendinger, also Brian Tabiner and Kirk Massey, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And have a good time in Columbus.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk more about the heart with an expert. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Newt Gingrich's campaign was revitalized by the $10 million donated to his PAC by casino mogul Sheldon Adelson and his wife. Adelson made much of his fortune from the casinos his company owns in Macau. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Lowell Bergman talks about his investigation into the Chinese mob's involvement in Macau's casinos. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And it's a story 200 years in the making, brought to life by Ballet Met, the CJO, and WOSU. Jazz Moves Columbus comes to the Capitol Theater and celebrates the city's history in vibrant songs, thrilling dances, and stirring images. Jazz Moves Columbus, the story of our city through kicks, turns, and trumpet blasts. It's now through February 12th. For tickets, call 614-469-0939 or visit balletmet.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
31 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect some light snow today, an inch or less of additional accumulation, and a high of 35 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 21. Sunshine for Thursday, a high of 39. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Heart disease is the leading single cause of death among women, accounting for one-third of all deaths of women. In the U.S., more women than men die every year of cardiovascular disease. Today on All Sides, we'll separate the facts from some of the myths surrounding heart disease and its impact on women and learn how women can reduce their risk for heart disease. Joining us now is Dr. Martha Gulati. She is the Director for Preventive Cardiology and Women's Cardiovascular Health and an Associate Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine at Ohio State University Medical Center. She is the co-author of a new book, Saving Women's Hearts: How You Can Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease with Natural and Conventional Strategies. For her commitment to women's heart health, Dr. Gulati is an honoree of the 2012 Women's Day Red Dress Awards, which will be presented February 15th at Lincoln Center in New York City. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gulati.
Thank you for having me.
Question for our listeners, for our women listeners, are you concerned about reducing your risks for heart disease and what are you doing about it? Or perhaps you suffer from heart disease now and tell us what you are doing about it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The 2012 Women's Day, meaning the magazine, just so everyone's clear, Red Dress Awards, they're a big deal. There are six honorees this year, including the 18th Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Regina M. Benjamin, and Star Jones, the television personality and heart disease survivor. And the ceremony is at Lincoln Center. It must be pretty cool. It must be exciting.
Yeah, it is quite exciting and quite the honor.
So why are the Red Dress Awards so important, and what does it mean to have an organization like Women's Day behind it?
Well, I think it means a lot because if you really look at the history of cardiovascular disease in women in terms of when we've cared about it, you know, since 1984, more women have been dying from heart disease than men, and yet most of the research related to women has only been in the last decade. And it is in the last decade that awards like the Red Dress Award have come out and been giving some credit to physicians and public celebrities who have made awareness about heart disease a main issue and bringing it into the mainstream. I think most of us recognize, you know, when you see the pink ribbon, everyone knows that means breast cancer. We're still trying to get the red dress and the symbol of red to mean heart disease and to make people aware that this is the month, this is the time that we're trying to get people to be aware of their own hearts.
You were one of the co-authors of the 2007 Evidence-Based Guidelines for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention in Women issued by the American Heart Association. One of their findings was that American physicians were largely unaware that more women than men die every year of cardiovascular disease. That was in 2007, and granted, it was still only since 1984, so in the big scheme of things, that's pretty fast that women took over that not exalted slot.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, one, the heart disease issue, it has been the number one killer for many years. And it's just the fact that more women than men are dying that we are really being aware of it. The guidelines that we put out, you know, they've been put out in 2004, then in 2007, and now most recently in 2011. And the reason we put out this guidelines was the exact issue that not only were our patients not always aware about heart disease affecting women, but also physicians are also not aware, and it's been increasing, that we've increased their awareness, and hopefully they're more apt to look at a woman and wonder if their heart's okay. But we still know that it is a major issue, both for our patient population and our physicians, to note the aware, you know, to know that women are also at risk.
Is this level of heart disease and death by heart disease among women peculiarly American?
No, actually, worldwide, it is becoming a serious issue as obesity is on the rise in the world, as diabetes is affecting populations like in countries like China and India that used to not have these issues. Now their diet has changed, too. And so we are seeing this trend across the world that heart disease is the number one killer of women all over the world, making it a very big public issue.
It almost sounds like we're killing ourselves. And when we talk about that, when it's spreading the way it is, because it's things that we put inside of our bodies, or it's a lack of exercise or whatever. And those have got to be some of the hardest issues to deal with people when you're talking about preventing disease.
They are. I would like to say, though, that I never will blame a patient for developing heart disease. There's some things that are certainly risk factors that you can be born with or somehow genetically predisposed to. And then there's also things that we've done. But in the end, when you start developing risk factors for heart disease or have, you know, suddenly have heart disease, the issue is to deal with them and treat them and modify them. The biggest thing that I think a lot of people would be surprised about is that 90% of heart disease is actually preventable. If we would treat the risk factors early, if we would identify those risk factors early, we can do something about them. Even if you're predisposed to high blood pressure, even if you've done everything right, there is ways for us to treat it, but you have to, as a woman, know that you have high blood pressure. If every time you go into the doctor's office and they tell you your blood pressure's fine, how are you to know any different? And the reason I bring that up as an example is because often a woman's blood pressure won't be fine. It won't be meeting the guidelines, but the doctor will attribute it to anxiety and stress and not worry about it and tell the woman, oh, well, it's a little high, but I'm sure you're having a rough day, rather than taking into consideration it's been high the last six appointments. That is not stress. That is her blood pressure. If you don't get the treatment or the advice, lower your salt, start eating more vegetables, let's see what happens to your blood pressure, lose some weight, you're not going to know you're at risk.
My guest is Dr. Martha Gulati. She is the Director for Preventive Cardiology and Women's Cardiovascular Health and an Associate Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine at Ohio State University Medical Center. She is an honoree of the 2012 Women's Day Red Dress Awards, which will be presented February 15th at Lincoln Center in New York City, of course. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Gulati, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. High blood pressure, you gave an example of how that's a common symptom, a common sign that's often overlooked. And you mentioned the fact that, well, they think, oh, well, it's stress or it's just been a bad week or whatever. How is that kind of the backdrop of why women's health, particularly in terms of heart disease, has been overlooked for so long?
We certainly know that for cardiac risk factors, we are less aggressive with women compared to men. And there's a lot of data. High blood pressure is one example. I could tell you the same for high cholesterol. I could tell you doctors don't like to talk to women about their weight and helping them get an exercise program. Those are the risk factors. But what we also know is that when someone presents with symptoms of having a heart attack, for example, for a woman, it will take longer for us to treat them. It will take longer for us to identify that they are actually having a heart attack. And that delays treatment. And time is heart muscle. I mean, if we are not as good at treating women aggressively and early and quickly, we are going to have more women die. And that's what we have right now, that women are more likely to die of a heart attack once they have it. They'll get delays in treatment. partially because we're not as good at recognizing them. If a man comes in having symptoms of a heart attack, he's going to get an EKG. They're going to make sure he isn't having a heart attack before they do anything else. And I kind of say this tongue in cheek, but a man will come in with a stubbed toe and he'll get an EKG, whereas a woman may be having jaw pain but no chest pain and not necessarily get an EKG, even though when you look at them and you say, look, they have the risk factors for a heart attack, could that jaw pain actually be them having a heart attack?
An article on the OSU Medical Center website says focus groups recently revealed that only 55% of women understand that heart disease is their number one killer, and that fewer than half know the healthy levels for cardiovascular risk factors, including the blood pressure and cholesterol. So this is really so much just about education.
It's a big part of it is education. We need women to know their own risk factors. They need to take control and be asking their doctor. So if you say my blood pressure is normal, what is that number? Is that really normal? They should know what's normal. They should know what their cholesterol numbers are, more than just their total cholesterol. They should be asking, what is my LDL cholesterol? Because I heard that that is the one that's really driving my risk of having a heart attack. They should be, we have to empower women to also take control, because we have to educate physicians. But in the meantime, women need to know that their hearts are okay.
You, as I mentioned earlier, are the co-author of a new book, Saving Women's Hearts, How You Can Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease with Natural and Conventional Strategies. What is the role of natural strategy?
Well, natural means to me a couple different things. Natural means that there's things that you can do that don't involve drugs, and that can be as simple as lowering salt in diet, exercising, choosing the right foods, eating more fruits and vegetables. But there's also some supplements, I mean, out there that women are always curious about what works, what doesn't work, what do we have data on. So those are what we mean by natural versus conventional. I mean, we traditionally think of those as medications that we can give. And I think there's a role for both. But there's also with the when people take supplements, I'm also very always concerned that with supplements, we need to know that they're safe and effective. A lot of women will watch television programs that will tell them they should be on folic acid. Well, folic acid is really good when you're a young pregnant woman or someone trying to get pregnant to prevent neural tube defects on your baby. But for heart disease, if anything, the evidence is showing that it's more harmful than good. And so this, you know, outside, you'll hear this all the time, folic acid will protect your heart. We have solid evidence that folic acid is actually potentially harmful for your heart. And so I think women need to know. They need to know the research that's been done. Anything they take in their body, they should know whether it's safe for them.
There is, I know at OSU and probably all over the place now, there are centers for women's health that are specifically focused on women. Is that helpful? It's nice, but is it really truly helpful?
I think it's helpful if it's all encompassing. So there's a lot of women's health centers out there, and they really do focus sort of like on the bikini symptoms. So they'll look at, you know, the breast and the reproductive system, and not necessarily on the heart. And when the heart is the number one killer, I'm against any women's health center that doesn't have heart disease in that umbrella. I think at OSU, we're lucky that the director of the Women's Health Center sees heart disease as a major issue, and we are part of that program. In addition, at our Ross Heart Hospital, we do have a Women's Cardiovascular Center because we can't replicate everything that we do as cardiologists to other sites, but we have a focused care on women there.
And you talked about the physicians and that they're one education, that's one level of the education process that you're working at. It's not just at the patients. Is that something that physicians in training are getting now, more information about that, instead of waiting until they're in practice and doing it as an extended, you know, continuing education credit somewhere?
Well, we have to cover all spectrums. So continuing medical education for those who haven't been exposed, right, and are out there practicing, we do have to teach them. But yes, now we are teaching our medical students, our residents, our fellows, we are teaching them about women and women's cardiovascular health so that it's being implemented into the curriculum of what they do, so that this generation of physicians will hopefully go out there and be fully aware that a woman's symptoms can be different, that women need to be screen, and that they are a little bit more sensitive to the differences that we've inflicted in terms of outcomes on women, that we've got to make that change over time.
At what point do you think that the research is going to catch up, the research on women catch up to what's been done and accepted for all people, but mostly it's been really been about men? Is there a certain point, or is that are we never going to catch up? Because no. The research, the longevity of it is helpful.
Yeah. Well, we are going to catch up. There's a big force in the United States of cardiologists who now study women who are making a difference. And we are at the infancy of caring for women. So I'll say, you know, in 10 years, we've found out a lot. And we've actually really been providing, you know, sort of the next amount of information that we need. But we have a long way to go. And we still have to figure out, there's so many different questions that we still have to iron out. But I think that, you know, more data, more studies, more funding from the NIH will make the difference. If we don't fund studies on women and their heart, then we're really doing women a disservice. And for that reason, I think women should be pushing their legislatures to allow research on heart disease. You know, there's a lot of push of funding about breast cancer, and we've made great strides in breast cancer, partially because of the amount of funding and public awareness and screening. But now these breast cancer survivors are living, and what are they dying from? They're dying from heart disease. So we have, if we care about our women, we've got to take it all encompassing and keep studying women.
Someone asked me recently, why is women's health so controversial? And of course, it stemmed in part from the controversy over the Susan G. Coleman controversy. You know, we don't have to get into that per se. But my response was, my sense is that women's health isn't controversial, and that's kind of part of the problem. It wasn't discussed at all.
I think that's the main issue, exactly, that it women's health isn't discussed. And there's a lot of people out there that will even say to me, well, you women, you live longer anyway. So what more do you want? Yeah, what more do you want? Why do you need to study it? You know, you got to die of something. The fact is that when there's differences in how we care for women, if there's differences in how we approach women, if there's differences to things that we can change in terms of our life expectancy, why not work for it? Why not work to make the changes? And this is, you know, I take care of men and women. And for all of them, I care that we try to prevent heart disease and that we try to treat them as quickly and aggressively as we can if they actually do have heart disease. So I just think for women, we've got to, you know, medicine has been a very predominantly male profession until the last few years. So I think even having female physicians has changed the focus.
One thing, under age 50, women's heart attacks are twice as likely to be fatal. Is that because younger women are that feeling of, you know, indomitability?
Well, it's a complicated answer, to be honest. The one thing is that often when a woman under 50 who comes in with symptoms that may be typical or atypical, whether they get recognized or not, most people look at a woman, and don't, especially a young woman, and do not think they're having a heart attack. So there's a delay in how aggressively we treat them. There is also the fact that women will often have the heart attack but not necessarily get the right treatment, which is, I think, very surprising to people, but is the honest truth. People will have a heart attack, and yet that women are less likely to go home with the standard of care of medications. Women are less likely to get referred for things like cardiac rehabilitation that have been proven to save lives. So we don't know why young women do worse entirely, but we certainly know some of the contributing factors.
Well, Dr. Martha Gulati, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
Dr. Martha Gulati, Director for Preventive Cardiology and Women's Cardiovascular Health and an Associate Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine at The Ohio State University Medical Center. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.